Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Got static on the brain, out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
If I asked you to give a stripped down, no more than 2 minutes description of what Operation Ivy was in the context of the history of music in America, how would you phrase that?
I would say Operation Ivy was a Bay Area punk band that brought in a lot of ska influences in the music that had a short, very active 2-year lifespan. And after they broke up, they achieved some posthumous wider recognition. But while the band was playing, they were essentially a high energy, popular but small punk band in the Bay Area.
I know things are getting tougher when you can't get the top off the bottom of the barrel. Wide open, roar my future now. Looking fucking narrow.
Sometime in late 400 BC, Socrates may have said, "I know one thing, that I know nothing." Historians now disagree on whether Socrates had actually said the words that translate to such a phrase, proving once again that we know nothing. Around 2,419 years later, Operation Ivy recorded their only LP, then questioned whether it should be released. They chose to record it again. Which is better? Who can ever say unless expressing opinion, which may or not be what we call facts? This podcast explores the first to be released, but second to be recorded, 1989 Lookout Records vinyl and cassette release of Energy by Operation Ivy. You will hear pieces written by performers, writers, and musicians who spent a good part of their life listening and being influenced by this band. You will also hear interviews by Operation Ivy singer, songwriter Jesse Michaels, and Lookout Record producer Larry Livermore. The pieces will occur in the exact order of the songs on the album itself, including pieces by Tim Stafford, Joe Jacobs, Bradley Adida, Matt Ellen, Connor Callista, and Sonia Amazonka.
Sound system.
Okay, so sound system. So Tim brought that in, and they played the intro, and then they just went into the riff. And at first, I didn't like it, but it just kind of came to life. And an interesting anecdote about that song is that Tim's little rap part, where he says, you know, wake up in the morning, bust the shade, let the sun in, was very true to life. Because he actually had this tiny room. He was living in this tiny room that was about the size of a large closet. And he had, you know, a boombox in there. And I think he literally would wake up, open the shade, and turn on his tape player back then. You know, it was a million years ago. So, anyway, there you go. Yeah. Slice of life.
That's kind of funny because every once in a while I tell the story of meeting you and you were in a small little teeny space. I can't remember where it was, but you were in a really teeny space too, right?
I've lived in many teeny spaces. I don't need much, John. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Not much else. I'm okay.
Many people see Operation Ivy as an ends to a means, an influential band that exploded fast and for a very short time. But putting this into the context of my own beliefs, I feel these time periods in our life are just part of a larger process. Does this idea resonate with you? And if not, do you have a theory of your own about your own creative journey over the years?
Well, I think that artistic processes, for me, art is always a means, is always an end in itself, so that each thing is completely distinct from the other. Of course, they're connected. But I mean, when you're making art of any kind, I think you get in a sort of altered state where you're not conscious of time, you're not conscious of the philosophy behind what you're doing. It becomes very intuitive. You know, it's not logical. So as far as Operation Ivy goes, It was an end in itself. The idea was to, you know, destroy the world and make this music. And then the next thing is the end in itself as well. But, you know, the different things that I do or that anyone does are connected by their personality. Obviously, if Rick James makes a record and then Rick James writes a book, you know, the common feature is his personality and his unique conditioning and his unique perspective on things. So obviously they're connected in that way, but when you're actually doing something, it's an end in itself, not part of a larger process.
In order for me to allow to commit to it and take risks on a project, I have to think that it's not an end. I have to think that it's more of an experiment that keeps on moving on, so that I don't limit myself when I'm working on one project.
Well, basically, if what I'm doing is any good, then I'm not thinking at all. So that's the sense in which it's an end in itself. It's basically when I stop thinking that stuff, when anything becomes any good artistically. I mean, an example of what I'm talking about is if I'm really involved with revising a song, probably the most intellectual part where I'm seeing what works and what doesn't, an hour can pass without me noticing. So in that way, I'm outside of the normal mental state.
Jaded.
Okay, Jaded was a sort of, you know, painfully earnest evaluation of the punk scene that I don't mean to get into self-parody, but you know, when you're young and really into punk, it just seems like the most important thing in the world. And of course it was important. But anyway, it's just a really earnest song about shitty punk club owners and how it all sucks. But once the band starts playing and the pit gets going, everything is cool. And so it's a little bit funny, but at the same time, there was actually a really meaningful and really important spirit at punk shows, and so while I look at it a little bit humorously, I still do also see the beauty of that scene that the song talked about.
My friends and I started skating together in high school. We were awkward and clumsy, a collection of scraped elbows and bruised shins. There were no mentors with sage advice on technique. All we had were magazines and the occasional VHS bootleg of a skate video to try and emulate. Now that was enough for some. Their attention to detail and natural athleticism helped them improve dramatically. Two-step gaps turned into six-step gaps. Ollieing that gap turned into kick-flipping that gap. I never reached the level of most of my friends. I put the blame on my lack of athleticism, my shoddy equipment, but the biggest reason I never got that good is I spent more time thinking about what song to use for my part in a skate video. I figured that the tricks would eventually come, not necessarily through practice, but something more closely resembling osmosis. It was not a matter of if I got offered a video part, but when. This might have come off as being a bit overconfident, but I was realistic. I knew I needed a short song because I did not know that many tricks. Luckily, all I listened to was punk rock, so all I had to choose from was short songs. I decided on Jaded by Operation Ivy. It starts off with 7 big crashes. I envisioned that every crash was timed with me landing an epic trick off a large obstacle. When the singer goes, "Whoa!" it speeds up, and this would be the section where I start showing off my technical prowess. Lines of tricks strung together effortlessly and fluidly. A kickflip to Smith grind on a bench to a 360 heel flip over a 4-stair gap. A nose slide on a marble bench, landing in a manual and doing a pop shove it over a hedge. Maybe throwing some footage of me getting chased by a security guard. My part would be awesome. My part never happened. There was footage of me, but how I looked in my mind and what I looked like on VHS was wildly out of whack. I envisioned myself gliding through tricks like I was Ed Templeton or Chris Markovich, but I resembled more of a methamphetamine addict in need of a fix. My knees were wobbly, my arms shaky, my stance was too wide, and my mechanics were jerky. It seemed that any time I would land a trick, it had more to do with luck than actual skill. The only part I could ever hope to be in was the blooper reel at the end. Operation Ivy would be an inappropriate choice for that clip. Maybe the Queers, but not Operation Ivy. I still ride a skateboard, though nowadays I am more in tune with my actual ability. More often you can find me pushing my son in a stroller through a cemetery because I live in a town that doesn't really believe in sidewalks. I'm waiting for extreme cemetery strolling to become an event at the X Games. If it ever does, I'm going to be huge, and I have the perfect song for my part.
I remember
remember just in that interview I was reading about you that the person who interviewed you actually had to look up the word jaded, which I was surprised. I mean, everyone has a word they don't never heard, but maybe that was such an 80s and 90s word that I was just surprised that someone didn't know what that word meant.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was just sort of, there was these words that sort of floated around the punk, you know, world. Like even the word scene, which is so common now, I think that kind of came from like, you know, early punk fanzines.
Yeah.
And other words that we take for granted, like poser, spelled P-O-S-U-E-R, that was like a total punk thing. And jaded was just kind of a word that floated around. And emo is another one, but that, you know, that existed way before its common usage. And jaded was just kind of a word that people used around the punk scene. And so that's where I picked it up. But I don't think I coined it in terms of that usage. Obviously, it's been around forever.
As you know, the album was recorded twice.
Right.
Two totally different versions of it, and there are a couple songs that are different between the two. A couple that, at least one sort of disappeared, and another one or two emerged. So I think it would be safe to say that they were still in the process of creating the record. You know, however, at that time, they already had a full-fledged show, you know, fully developed show where they could play a half hour or 45 minutes with nothing but awesome songs and audiences going crazy. So I don't think there was ever any doubt in their mind or in mine that they would be able to come up with an album if once they went into the studio. One of the factors that was a consideration, however, was they were one of those bands that at the beginning had a reputation as a live, you know, you got to see them live. That was where they built their initial fame. They were not really thought of as a recording band. For instance, even the songs on the first 7-inch, by the time that they recorded them and we issued that 7-inch in January of 88, I mean, those songs were already, you know, so all the kids at Gilman knew those songs and could sing every word of them. So there was some question on how well things would translate on vinyl. Stand by our friend. Run all right. Can't call that justice. If it's just a stupid excuse to fight. The way that Lookout came into being and everything about it was probably a series of crazy and not very well thought out decisions. And this was just one of them. I first met Lint maybe even before Gilman opened back in 86. He was still playing in a band called Basic Radio, but I didn't know him very well. He was just this really enthusiastic kid. And I mean, kid literally. He was probably 20, 21 at the most, but he had the manner of just a kid. And he would bounce around, bounce off the walls, jump on everybody and hug them. He was just so enthusiastic about Gilman and about punk rock and everything. But his band, Basic Radio, broke up. And so I would see him at Gilman shows all the time, and he would be just kind of, you know, yo, Larry, how you doing? How you doing? Oh, man, I'm so bummed out my band broke up. I don't know. And then there came a time when I'd been away for a couple months, and the first time I saw him, when I came back, he virtually jumped up into my arms to hug me, hello, and says, Larry, I'm in a band now. I got a new band. It's awesome. We're going to play. We're going to play tonight. When I realized at that point that this was the band that I had been hearing stories about, I had been away out of the country for a couple months, and people had been talking about this band called Operation Ivy, and that they were the new favorites at Gilman, taking the place of Isocracy. So I was like, well, that's exciting. I want to watch you. And they got up on stage, and it was one of those quintessential defining moments. I have a feeling that if that moment had not occurred, there would have been no Lookout Records, because that's how central the Gilman and the Operation Ivy experience was to it. No one's got a thing against you. Well, you got something to prove. We don't need no new set of standards. We don't need no new set of rules. Even at that time, I was already fairly well along in life. I've seen a lot of shows in a lot of different settings, and everything from the original Woodstock Festival to the MC5 playing in a parking lot in 1965. There was something that was, you know, only a handful of times I ever seen that level of intensity and magic, where the minute they started playing, the whole room just went immensely crazy. They were up on the stage, they were singing every word. And here's the crazy part. I was singing every word, and I had never heard one of their songs before, and somehow I knew the words, and I was totally into it. All I could think about was, like, this is it. The world has to know about this. And so the minute the show was over, Lint came running up and said, so you saw my band, what do you think? And I said, I want to put out a record with you guys. Uh-huh. You know, bear in mind, there was no Lookout Records, and it was just a fantasy. I was not a record company. I had no knowledge of how to really put out records successfully. I didn't have any of the wherewithal to do so, and yet that's all I could say was, I want to put out a record with you guys. And he was like, what? Yeah, okay, I guess that would be cool. He told me many times over the years since then, we thought you were completely crazy, but, you know, we did want to have a record. Why don't you just ease up? At that point, I went to see David Hayes, who was my friend, and he had sort of a tape label where he was doing compilations of local bands, and we often speculated about if we were going to do a label, who would we do bands, which ones would we do? And I said, well, I think this is actually going to happen. We're actually going to have a record label, and I just asked Operation Ivy, and he did. He said, well, maybe you ought to, like, listen to their demo tape and see who you just agreed to do a record with. So, because I didn't even know they had a demo tape, and he handed it to me, and I took it home, and I was like, oh, this isn't that really that good. I mean, it's okay, but it's not record quality. It's not, it's like, you know, like a new band. And I was, like, really kind of scared that, like, oh, wait, they're not really ready. Maybe 6 months or a year they might be ready, but it was too late. I mean, I had said I was going to do it. Luckily, my fears were misplaced. When they went into the studio and did their first songs, they were every bit good enough and better than good enough.
I didn't have a wise older brother to share his hand-me-down record collection. And during middle school, my coolest friend was listening to stuff like Frampton Comes Alive. So as far as I'm concerned, after first hearing an album like Energy a decade after it had already been released, I was the guy who discovered punk rock in Midwestern suburbia. Which is why I have a somewhat unique understanding of the crowd. Rented to the world, the end of the time. Were you just about to wake you up, me up in night? Waking by a lock, 50 minutes of 5 days. Some people think the song is a kind of indictment of the supposed real world, where people are just an impersonal mob, and that try as they might to overcome its crushing banality through, say, alcohol, they just end up numbing their senses, creating a liquid bread for the poor diet that just reinforces the subjugation of the proletariat. But by that logic, you'd also assume that the refrain of More Than Just a Crowd is a rallying cry for the underground scene at the time to band together, overcoming violence and sectarianism so as not to fall into the same trap. It's a valid reading and one I'm not trying to fault you for. The song is actually about something a lot simpler. Me. I was a weird kid, often found myself isolated from others. So when I first heard Jesse Michaels wailing against the depersonalization of the very society I just couldn't find a way to relate to, it reassured me. I wasn't alone after all. I wasn't crazy. There was an entire population of people I'd never met, and they felt just as disaffected as I did. It brought visions to my young mind of a kind of utopia, a fellow social outcast. I never did find that place. Don't get me wrong, I did manage to meet plenty of self-identifying punks. Apparently, since my introduction of punk music into the suburbs, I'd inadvertently created a whole set of subcultures and subgenres, with their own rules, dress code, and carefully argued set of vocabulary, just as regimented and alienating as those I was running from. But the music hasn't gone anywhere. That's the beauty of lines like, you gotta get away any way that you can. They aren't time sensitive. That's why it feels just as vital and urgent now as when I'd heard it for the first time, already 10 years late to the party. It's why the same words written about the East Bay scene of California's late 80s are just as applicable to the satellite cities of Northwest Chicago in the early aughts. Idealism doesn't have an expiration date. I like to think of The Crowd as a positive song. Not about the dangers of disunity, but about the possibility of transcending them. More than just another crowd.
February 94, I was a freshman at Glenbrook South High School in Glenview, Illinois. Looking for places to perform the juggling skills I had learned a few years earlier, I found a small group of students who were preparing for a show they called Paradox. It was there that I met Emily, Wendy, Katrina, and Chapel, who took me under their wing and introduced me to punk rock. Emily gave me a mixtape which became a kind of punk rock Rosetta Stone. She had designed the mix to give me a good variety of the best punk and punk-related subgenres current at the time. Listening to this tape in early 94 marked my first real entry into the world of punk. The tape started off with Oblivion, then My Brain Hurts and Anthem-era Screeching Weasel, then The Queers, 88 Fingers Louie, and The Pseudo-Hippies. Next on the tape was Operation Ivy with Hoboken, which was my first exposure to the band, so that song came from the Hectic EP. The NoFX song Bob was next, followed by The Vindictives, and then Detroit by Rancid. The following song on the tape was the first song I ever heard from Operation Ivy's Energy LP, Bombshell. With clanging guitars and throbbing bass lines, Bombshell clocks in at 1:03. The narrator tells of a woman he meets at a party who invites him back to her place, but then suddenly disappears the next day. He spends the next month trying to find her, but in the end concludes that she's a bombshell, she's blown to hell, all while the backup vocalist chimes in, oh yeah, as a response to each line. The genius of the sound was in the balanced combination of hardcore and ska. Hearing this song in the idyllic suburb of Glenview helps paint a picture of the gritty reality of urban living. My friends and I refer to our insular suburb as a white bubble. Getting involved in punk rock meant a way for us to break out. I thought of Bombshell in the context of other songs and bands on that mixtape, and then started to piece together a mental picture of punk rock life by reading Maximum Rock and Roll and Comet Bus, buying records, going to shows, and eventually carving out a punk existence of my own. Oh yeah.
I bought Energy in the summer of 2012, not long ago at all. I had heard the name in many places before, ever since I got super into punk on account of attending a show with a friend that April. I had heard some songs before on YouTube and was familiar with them, but I couldn't listen to the whole thing online because I like to possess material music, and I find that it helps me get into the band just a little bit more. Anyway, upon listening to this CD, I realized that this band was really more than just another storybook on punk rock's fully stocked shelf. I was used to the tough guy punk bands, enjoyed by the people who would yelp anarchy as loud as they could possibly muster, some without any clue as to what that could possibly mean. The people who, at the sight of a poser, would clench their fist, yell fuck you, and start a riot. Immediately, you know, of course I felt out of place because I was skinny, I was suburban, I believed that the whole anarchy ideology was something of a failure. Sure, I was angry and for a reason too, but I didn't waste my time grilling posers or go around advocating a cause that I had never believed in. I found the Descendants album Milo Goes to College, which was a huge help, but I needed more bands to whisk me away from this sort of sea of over-exaggerated punk rock machismo. And the key band to doing that, I think, was Operation Ivy. My only punk rock friend and I would always filter them into our music conversations. We'd talk about how cool an album Energy was, how Jesse Michaels, the singer, wrote amazing lyrics, and how we liked them better than Rancid, the slightly more popular band formed by Operation Ivy guitarist Tim Lind Armstrong and bassist Matt Freeman. In a way, the definitive tough guy punk band. I don't even know if I have a favorite song by Operation Ivy, but Unity comes damn close.
There's a war coming down between my breasts and mine. I don't want no war.
The song is a brief and hooky manifesto of the punk rock scene in Berkeley, California, and its general prejudice. Some people interpret the song to be a battle cry against racist, homophobic, or misogynist ideals. Others say the song deals with the closed-mindedness of the scene at the time, rejecting new thoughts, ideas, and styles of music. I say it's both of those things. I assumed Operation Ivy singer Jesse Michaels to be something of a left person, something I wrongly assumed of everyone in punk, until I discovered that that one Vandals drummer, later bassist Joe Escalante, was a pretty big conservative. Anyway, I think Jesse Michaels promoted all the positive traits that leftists are associated with. What Michaels is more or less trying to display in Unity is that punk had become, and currently is, a high school locker room. A sweaty, smelly crowd of self-enhanced adolescents. You'd stay away if you weren't white, male, Christian, and fucking huge. If you had a tiny dick, you knew pictures of it would be posted on the bulletin board in the hallway. And it's no different today in the year 2013. Not only in high school locker rooms around the world, but in the worldwide, now expanded, yet condensed, punk rock scene. I hear these cries of poser and sellout all throughout the music forums of the internet, directed at this or that band. And you know what? It's true that Operation Ivy reportedly broke up to avoid mainstream success as they were getting a lot of attention. It's things like this that I believe they formed the fight. This kind of like, this obsession with authenticity. You know, to a degree, I understand it. But, you know, every now and then, it's just kind of like, shut the fuck up and just really enjoy punk music, you know? And Unity really clarifies that the band was really all about this. And while the song is relatable to me, I think that the concept of Unity itself is dead and gone. And though they may never reunite, the music of Operation Ivy will always exist to stop this war.
One step together, unity. Evolution gotta come right, unity. As one step together, unity. Evolution gotta come.
Vulnerability.
That one was very influenced by Stiff Little Fingers. In the vocal, you can hear I really kind of do it grindy. Like it's very, has that sort of abrasive Jake Burnsy feel. He was the singer for SLF, or at least it tries to. And so that was the influence there. And I think the kind of earnest political content speaks to that also. The song is about, I was outside a Ramones concert in, you know, the mid-80s or something, and there was this rock photographer shooting photos, and this guy in a car, just a drunk driver, killed him, and I actually saw him die. Oh. And so that's what the lyrics are about. It's about this public death and the comments I heard in the crowd and this feeling that people aren't really connecting with what's actually happening, but instead are sort of retaining their, you know, social face or whatever, and are kind of, you know, it's such a cliche word, but they're desensitized to actually feeling anything about this death that took place right in front of them.
Your father was Leonard Michael, a novelist, short story writer, and intellectual. Do you feel your relation with his legacy is one of rebellion against, in accordance with his influence, or any other sort of influence?
Definitely not rebellion against, but also not, you know, I was influenced by him personally because he was my father. Sense of humor and his view of things, and he had certain values that influenced me. He was very loyal. He was funny. He was an outsider. He really believed in being truthful. So those things influenced me. But I wasn't really directly influenced by his work, except maybe in my writing a little bit, but not that much. So if anything, it's just sort of a parallel process.
That's interesting to me, because I know a lot of the stream that goes through punk is a sort of rebellion against the parents, and even Ben was a big example in our band, but I never had that either. Like, I didn't have this rebellion instincts against the parental influence, but I felt like there was some kind of rebellion that I never quite understood. This, you know, something that made me sort of veer from the path. Does that relate to you at all? I mean, this idea of rebellion?
It does in a way, except I would describe it more as a kind of an insistence on truth. Like, to me, basically, to put it really simply, the world sucks, and it's controlled by the worst, most self-centered people in the universe, and no one really talks about it that much, except they did a lot in punk. Bands were talking about all sorts of stuff that was going on politically and socially and everything else. So that's what I relate to, this insistence on telling the truth about things in the world that other people will just sort of take for granted.
Well, like when they made the EP, I think the recording was done in November maybe of 87. And at that time, they'd barely been a band for 6 months. And David Hayes, my partner in Lookout Records at the time, basically was in charge of shepherding all the bands in and out of the studio very rapidly because we didn't have very much money to pay for a recording. It was just like almost a shuttle system. I remember being outside the studio, and it's like one band would be walking in and the other would be walking out, and David would be like, okay, guys, let's move it, and, you know, in a genial enough way.
Yeah.
It just happened. It was smooth. It was flowing. Whereas with the album, it was like at every point, it was like, is this going to happen? Are the lyrics going to get written? Is the recording studio going to work out? I mean, right from the beginning, it was later that summer of 88, we were at a show up in Arcata, the first time we'd played up there, my band and Operation Ivy and Isocracy and Crimshrine. And we were sitting outside the burrito joint in before the show started, and David Hayes and I were kind of like, well, so the EP did pretty good. What do you guys want to do next? Don't you think it might be time to start thinking about doing another EP? And Matt and Lint sort of looked at each other and said, well, actually, we decided we want to do an album. And, you know, David and I were both taken aback because at that time, Lookout was still a pretty small thing and not really thinking in terms of albums. I mean, EPs were a big deal still to us. And we were kind of like, well, it might be a little soon for that. I mean, you know, you haven't even been a band a whole year yet. You're doing great, but, and there's not that much money, you know. And they sort of considered it, and then they looked at each other and looked back and said, no, if we want to do anything, we're going to do an album. And that kind of summed up the way dealing with Operation Ivy was. You know, they would listen to whatever your opinion was, and they would respectfully consider it, but when they told you what was what, that was what was what. You were not going to change them. I don't know who said this first, because Lint always used to quote me saying it, or I don't know if he said it first or I, but he'd say, you can tell Operation Ivy, but you can't tell them much.
Backside! These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are going to walk all over you.
Sunday, April 10th, 1988, Ben Foster and Matt Nelson separately, but eventually together, started booking a show.
Walk all over you.
Two separate lists of bands began to grow, because where else were these bands going to play in Chicago? When the amount of bands got ridiculously large and Ben and Matt discovered they were booking shows for the same day at the same venue, we all decided that we would make it an all-day event. The venue was Dirty Nelly's in the Chicago suburb of Palatine. On the roster was Toxic Reasons, KGB from Germany, Zero Boys, Sloppy Seconds, Desperate Minds from Canada, Ozfish Experience, Dirty Dishes, and for the first and last time in or near Chicago, except for a basement show in Rockford the next night, was Operation Ivy.
One of these days, these boots are going to walk all over you.
To make sure all the bands got money, Ben, Matt, and I split all the jobs of running the show. I was in charge of sound. I had a DJ company with Matt called Out of Control, but I had never run sound for a rock venue before, and now I was running sound for 8 bands from all over the US, Canada, and Germany. Toxic Reasons, still one of my favorite hardcore bands to this day, lead singer slash guitarist, came up to me after the show and said that that was the most kick-ass sound they had ever had in a small venue. The sound system there was shit. I was proud of myself. I turned a pile of shit into a rock of ass. Walk all over you. I've never been one for all-day music festivals. Once I experienced being on stage, I could barely tolerate being off stage. Screeching Weasel had just played there a week or two prior, so we were not on the bill. We promised ourselves that we would never play our own town more than once a month, and hardly even that. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. Booking this venue not only helped bring in bands to the suburbs that never would have stood a chance otherwise, but it also allowed us to make instant connections that allowed us to travel the country, playing small venues while other Chicago bands were boring their own audiences by playing just a little bit too often in the same places week after week. I would like to say that the Operation Ivy set blew me away, and it probably would have if there weren't hundreds of kids jammed into a small space in front of me, behind me, on top of me, sweating, while I was trying to mix the band's sound. I do remember thinking that this band placed in the middle of the lineup would be hard, if not impossible, to top. No one knew who they were at the beginning of their set, but by the end of their set, everyone knew who they were. And the old stalwarts of punk rock, Toxic Reasons, KGB, and Sloppy Seconds knew they were being challenged to deliver the goods. The presence of Operation Ivy on this day not only boosted their own recognition, but caused the following bands to give it their all. To give their all to a suburban audience that hardly ever made it to the big city known as Chicago. P.S. During the show, I noticed that the singer guitarist from Desperate Minds looked strangely similar to the guitarist for Operation Ivy. I introduced the two, and after a night of them talking together, Lint from Operation Ivy came up to me and said, "Hey, we just found out that we're cousins."
Gonna find you.
That was a song about cutting school. It's just kind of funny, you know, the stuff is funny now just because I had such a different perspective. I still stand by and very much identify with a lot of values in the songs, but the actual situations at times are, you know, kid stuff. And that one was about cutting school. And then the larger story is it's about, you know, how society is pressurized into these life templates that we're kind of, you know, forced or coerced into trying to fit into. And so the idea is, even if you try to be an independent soul, there's this pressure to kind of fit into some sort of preordained way of being or life choice.
Back in school, you ever get busted for trying to walk and have some administrator tell you, "Son, you can
shut up." Is it important to you to be understood?
For me, it's very important to, it's a paradox. In order to make good music, you have to, at the same time, be very concerned what people think and whether or not they get it. And at the same time, you have to not care at all. So in other words, if I'm writing a song, I definitely want people to get it and I want to write it for an audience. But at the same time, in order to do that effectively, I have to be completely independent and not care what anybody thinks about me.
I like criticism, but I have to turn it off and distance myself from it, or else it affects me too much. Like, I make choices that don't feel inherent to what I wanted to do. That brought up, because when I was talking to Larry, I had told him that I don't really listen to lyrics to songs, and only sometimes, in retrospect, I'll go back and look at lyrics when I'm studying them or interviewing somebody. And he had said that he had that same reaction when he first heard you guys, when he asked you guys, you know, wanted to start a label and do a record. He didn't even consider what actually you were saying until much later. Does that, I'm not disturbing you, but does that surprise you?
Well, it doesn't surprise me because I don't really listen to lyrics either. I have albums that I've listened to 1,000 times and I barely know the words, you know? Mm-hmm. I could barely remember my own words. So I guess, you know, it's sort of odd, but I'm not a lyric retainer.
Do you think that then people can respond to what you're saying emotionally and with the lyrics just sort of washing over them?
Yeah, I think they get it. I think there's a vibe, you know, a vibration in the music, an emotional currency, or I don't know what to call it. You can just hear it. You know what I mean? Like, the first time I heard Black Flag, for example, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but I got it. Especially for punk, because it's so immediate. It's not like deeply, you know, subtle music that holds things back. It's all sort of there.
I also feel that, and I don't know how I feel about it, but I have had experiences with Weezer where I think that is also misunderstood, where someone has rioted to violence or something, and they think we're going to enjoy that sort of attitude, and it seems contrary to what we're saying. Do you ever feel that it is completely misunderstood, and even in vibe?
I do, but, you know, generally speaking, at least with Operation Ivy, there was a pretty good correspondence to the actual content of the lyrics and so on, and the way the audience responded. There was a sort of euphoric thing about our music, you know, for better or worse, and people took it that way. And generally, people at our shows had similar values to us. There seemed to be a good match in that way.
Bad Town.
Bad Town, we played a show in L.A., and it was at the Hoover Recreation Center or something. I might have some of this wrong, but Hoover as in the Hoover Street Crips. it was in South Central, and although I don't think there was any, you know, literally, like, gangsters from South Central at the show was just a bloodbath. I mean, there's endless fights and big groups of kids beating people up. I think one of the bands actually got beat up. And so Tim wrote that song after that show.
We're going to continue with another cliche, actually. Now, making big waves in the States, spiking up the myopic scene over there, leading the way for other bands. We hope they all follow, and we hope you love this.
This song always reminds me of that song by Fear. Ryan put it on a mixtape for me once. It was on Side A after Smash It Up by The Damned. Ryan gave me mixtapes. Regional samplers of SoCal punk or Discord releases, all of them with illegibly scrawled liner notes. My friend Ben, on the other hand, preferred to record whole albums. He gave me the 90-minute TDK cassette with London Calling on the A-side and Energy on the B-side. I could still see the band names on the tape label. Yeah. Bad Town was a gateway song. I used to put it on mixtapes for people who might otherwise be punk-averse. In a tape that I made for my dad, I wedged the song between Fleetwood Mac's Secondhand News and I Will Follow by U2. It was in the middle of Side A of a tape that I made for Julie. A tape that was eaten by her tape deck when we were sitting in her car in the parking lot behind school. No more Bad Town. All of this was before the road trip to Austin and before the car accident after that. Before Simons put it on their jukebox. Before compact discs. Before shared playlists, when you could still hear the needle against the record. Before I moved away.
Smiling when your friends are watching, I just came up with that chorus. It was just a good hook, you know what I mean? That song is definitely influenced by the Specials. The Specials have a lot of songs about being self-conscious in a crowd. It's one of their strong points, I think. I mean, one of the cool sort of lyrical themes of the Specials. And, you know, like even like Concrete Jungle or Naked Woman, Naked Man, there's a lot of sort of voyeuristic stuff and self-voyeuristic stuff, like examining social roles. And that's kind of was the influence of that song. And that song sort of critiques people who try, you know, a person who tries to be a ladies' man, and they're basically just being a big phony.
Smart friends, watching you.
the album specifically was like an epic journey and project in itself that took on its own life and very nearly didn't come to fruition. I mean, there were several points, turning points at which it could just not have happened at all and came close to not happening at all. I remember the last few weeks when we were scrambling to put the last couple pieces together, one of them being the cover art, which Jesse was notorious for. He always would produce great art, but only at the last possible second. You know, it would be like staying up all night, leaving messages for him, and going by his house and, "Hey, do you think it might be ready soon?" "Oh yeah, pretty soon." And I may be confusing it with art he did for another album cover, but I think this was for the Op Ivy one. It just like showed up on the doorstep at dawn, and it was like the last possible minute it could have. And that was kind of the way it was. It, you know, so much upheaval had happened. It just really seemed hard to believe that that this album was finally actually going to come into being. You know, I didn't even dare believe that it was until I actually held it in my hand. It was right about that time that they announced the breakup. They did play their last show of, I think there was a lapse of about a few weeks before, from the time they announced it until they actually played their last show. In terms of identifying a record with the band and the whole experience of the band and their place in the scene and the culture and all, I would be much quicker to identify the 7-inch, which I'm sure you know also, the Hectic 7-inch.
Right.
That kind of came out organically, right, just as Operation Ivy were beginning to hit their stride as a band, and just as Gilman was really taken off, and of course it was just one of the first four official releases of Lookout Records too, so it was right square in the middle of it, and it had a very different feel to it. It was easy, it was fun, it was exciting, whereas the album, obviously one of the great punk rock albums of all time, but it was hard work.
Caution was a word that, I mean, caution was a song that started going into lyrics. Tim brought the first line. You know, as you're saying these, I'm realizing how many of the songs he wrote the first lines for. So that one, you know, his prompt was the first line, C-O-U-T-I-O-N is a word I could not understand. Then I related that to methamphetamine, which was just becoming popular back then, and which is something I may or may not have experienced. and so I made it a song about speed. It's, the song goes, "Walk the dog with a real short leash. We used to call speed the dog." And so that's what that was about. Stainless steel and painted glass refers to a razor and a mirror.
Feel that you're competing with your former selves, not even just Operation Ivy, but in general in creations and how they're accepted? And then my second part of that question is, and is there a judgment on feeling such things?
I don't. I think, and sometimes I think people sort of bring that to the table who are really interested in Op Ivy and are talking to me about other stuff. I think what a lot of people don't realize is how little I care about Operation Ivy. And I say that not cynically, but it's kind of like your high school football game. You know what I mean? Like, any person who is mature is not going to go through the rest of their life thinking about how they had the great high school season where they ran 500 yards or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know. I know exactly what you're saying.
I just basically never think about it. I don't care about it. And I don't refer to it, except I will say that I'm very grateful for the advantages that having a little bit of sort of weird success has given me. I mean, it would be naive for me to say that it hasn't opened doors and allowed me to have relationships with people who otherwise might not answer my emails. And yeah, I mean, social purchase of any kind is hard to come by, and it's rad. But I certainly, I don't even affiliate myself with Op Ivy that much anymore, just because it was so fucking long ago, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, and that's also, I think, good to hear for audiences to hear. I think also having grown up in scenes and being with both theater people and musicians and meeting you guys, it's so natural to me to think that way. But I think people who are even just discovering it now, that it's hard to distinguish the importance of that to themselves. And I think you saying what you're saying can be shocking to some people.
Well, I mean, basically, so I like Hop Ivy. I think it was good. But the truth is that I participated in something that took on its own life aside from my life. You know what I mean? Like, my bit was to write some lyrics and be involved and do these shows and stuff like that. And then the life it took on, which was actually mostly after I was done doing it, became something much more public, became something, you know, much more widespread. And that's great, and I'm very grateful for that. But I sort of, you know, mentally associate with what I did, which was just, you know, being an unhappy young person in a punk band, which is what 5,000 other people have done without the notoriety. So the notoriety is a happy coincidence, but I don't necessarily attach that to my identity.
Frieza?
That one is kind of longer than our other songs, and, you know, it's just sort of, it was a chance to write some kind of complex lyrical stuff, and it's just about the world. It's just about how the world's fucked up and how, you know, if you think about it too much, you'll start to feel a sense of impending doom. And it sort of has an apocalyptic vibe, like something like London Calling does, although that wasn't an intentional connection. But that's kind of the type of vibe it has, sort of a paranoid examination of life in the contemporary world.
Operation Ivy is one of those bands I always keep coming back to, ever since I was 14 years old. Energy was actually the first album I ever borrowed from someone to make a copy. I had heard the song Gonna Find You somewhere, and I really liked it and wanted to track down the elusive Operation Ivy. This was Serbia in the year 2000. Record stores were virtually non-existent, and the places where you could buy pirated music yielded no results. And to top it all off, my circle of punk rock friends was small, and most of them were into bands like The Exploited, so that was a dead end. I just started high school, and I was kind of shy and socially awkward. But I had noticed this girl who looked like she might be into punk rock. So one day in gym class, I worked up the courage to talk to her, and I asked her something to the effect of, "Izvini milice, Ash, da ti slušaš?" When she answered that she did indeed like punk, I asked her if she had anything by a band called Operation Ivy. She said, "Yeah, sure." And the next day, she brought me a cassette of Energy to school. The copy was horrible. It was taped over some sort of hip-hop album, which you could hear as background noise, and it kind of broke through and cut into Big City a couple of times. But I didn't care. I was completely hooked. I think I had that tape in my Walkman for 2 months straight. If I had to pick a favorite song, I'd go with Freeze Up. There's something in the ominous tone of that song that really resonated with me when I first heard it. In a country that was shot to shit by NATO bombs just a year earlier, and lost its industry to economic collapse and corruption, the image of empty factories and the whole wasteland feel of the song made it somehow sound urgent and important. And with all the crazy stuff that was going down in Serbia in 2000, the huge political changes and the ensuing chaos of hope and expectations, it really was important to ask yourself, what's my place in this hell? And it does still ring true that nothing can be changed except ourselves. So even though I always liked knowledge and Room Without a Window, Freeze Up embodied in song form the uncertainty and anxiety about the future, which I'd felt all my life and still feel. Sort of like the punk rock version of Winter Is Coming. A really, really awesome and powerful song. Oh yeah, that girl that I borrowed the tape from in the first place, Milica, we bonded over a mutual love of Operation Ivy, and she's been my best friend ever since.
What do you think you've learned during your short, very productive time in Operation Ivy? What do you think was learned that you use now?
The thing that I use now is go with your feelings and go with the energy. Don't pursue cold leads. In other words, in Op Ivy, we wrote 4 or 5 songs for every song we played. It was completely instinctual. Everybody felt it. The songs that worked were hot. And I've been in other bands, and I've seen other bands where they pursue every song and try and make it work. But personally, I work better off of energy, and I know it's kind of repetitive since the record is called that, but you go with what works, and don't spend too much time trying to save the dying patients.
In the theater, they call it killing your babies.
You kill your babies, yeah. And like this last band that I was in, Classics of Love, we made this record, and we used largely the same process. We got rid of a lot of songs that were so-so, and some of them weren't easy to get rid of because, you know, it might have a great hook or something, but you just know when something is really good. It runs on its own momentum. You don't have to prop it up, and that's the stuff that we keep. And that's probably what I learned from Op Ivy.
Do you think there was a sort of a lyrical unity between Tim's lyrics and yours? And does that make a difference to how a band is perceived to the public?
Well, Tim wrote a very small percentage of the lyrics. And I'm not saying that to blow my own horn or anything like that. But strictly to clarify your question, he was so in tune with, as I said, that intuitive vibe of the music, that the lyrics were often really very perfect and would define the whole song and would allow me to write, you know, reams of other verses just from his simple starting point. So in that sense, yeah, definitely. We connected well in writing in that way, and it worked.
Room without a window.
The position being taken is not to be mistaken for attempted education or righteous accusation. Only a description, just an observation.
So, Room Without a Window is just about having a limited perspective and being narrow-minded, being caught in dogmatic views, which is the theme to a lot of my lyrics. And the crazy thing about that song is, so you can hear the beginning. The break is totally rushed. The vocals on the break, it's like, burn. It has some stabs, and then I'm like, the position be did, blah, 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 blah. And they actually recorded the music first, and I found that it was too fast for me to, like, it's slightly faster than the rest of the song, I think. We weren't working with a click, so I had to somehow jam all those lyrics into that part. So if it sounds slightly awkward or crazy, that's why. It was slightly awkward and crazy.
The position being taken is not to be mistaken for attempted education or righteous accusation. Only a description, just an observation of the pitiful condition of our generation.
Big City, that song is just about urban environments and how they're kind of indifferent. Like, if you get beaten up by the city, then, you know, no one cares and you sort of disappear. And, you know, anyone who's ever walked through a big city can sense, you can feel the sense of danger and the sense of kind of, you know, the city glitters and it offers all these attractions, but at the same time, it can be extremely heartless and brutal.
Was that based on any kind of experience, or was it just a broad feeling about big cities?
I don't really, yeah, it was just kind of, you know, a lot of the songs I would sort of take a global view of the world and find something I didn't like, you know, and sing about it. I don't know why, you know what I mean? It's just punk music, and the music that I grew up listening to was basically protest music, and that was just sort of the motif that I like to use and still do. So, and that was one of those things where you look around the city, you see a lot of things that aren't that cool, and then you know, I decided to write a punk song about it.
No, wait a second. I would slap my fingers like this against the steering wheel to the beat of the opening chords. This is what I was doing when a blue Ford pickup truck that was in front of me in the turn lane stopped short, and I ran into him. I was trying to turn onto I-30 just past the bowling alley to go home. I was driving my car home from Ryan's place, where I had left it in the driveway while he drove us to Austin. It sounded worse than it was, the wreck, and even then it didn't sound all that bad. It was just a low, crunching, cracking sound. But when the blue Ford turned off his engine, this song was the only sound in the world, and it was a song that, to be honest, I think I understood a little more than half of the words to. It was a song that I was sure someone in a blue Ford would be pissed off by. And it was a song that was loud. It was way too loud. Christ, do I listen to music this loud? And in a rush to turn it off, I twisted it up. And now I was just frantically pushing and pulling and swiping at the console. And then the blue Ford was tapping on my window. And finally, my stereo was off. And The guy was nice about it, asked if I was all right. My driver's side headlight was out. His truck didn't have a scratch on it. He offered me $100 cash to call it even. And this, to my 17-year-old ears, sounded like a great deal. And as he's pulling 20s off of his money clip, I'm still worried that he's going to ask me about the music, because that's what a 17-year-old would worry about. And it's not until I've gotten back into my car and rewound the song that I realized the guy probably didn't have insurance, that a headlight probably costs more than $100, and that this song sounds really good loud.
Missionary.
So Missionary was a song that Matt and Tim wrote that they deliberately were riffing off The Who. We used to do this. We used to listen to stuff like The Who or The Bad Brains, and then we'd go in the studio and just be excited. And then, you know, sort of play around with it, almost like air guitar, but with real guitars. Anyway, so that beginning of the song, you can totally tell it sounds like Won't Be Fooled Again or something like that. And then I don't really remember exactly where the lyrics come from. The only kind of anecdotal thing I can tell you about that song is it's the last song we wrote. You know, it was near the last song we wrote as a band, and it appears last on the album.
Well, I don't want to get too far into it because it's kind of personal to the band, but I was sort of in the middle of it when the actual breakup happened, and two of them came to me and told me about it, and they were just like devastated, you know. And I was like thrust into one of those positions like I kind of described earlier, where I was torn between my two roles, like as the record label do, shouldn't I be trying to get them to patch it up and make more records, but as the friend and the advisor and the confidant, I should be like, no, I'll support you whichever, I mean, however this works out, and you know, just tell me how you're feeling about it. But they were just devastated, and, you know, I kind of was too, you know, both for selfish reasons, like not only that would I have liked to keep working with them, but I had booked them to play at a benefit show I was doing a few weeks after that, and suddenly realized that there went my benefit show out the window. Also, it's, in dealing with, whether you're dealing with people or art or both, you know, this kind of, it's kind of a kick in the gut to see the ultimately ephemeral nature of all things, to say, like, just when we finally get something going, you know, bang, it's gone. You never know. I mean, you should treasure it as much as you can, and yet you don't know how long this magic is going to be here. I mean, the band itself might hang around for 5, 10, 20 years, but that moment that made them shine above all else, you know, that might last one night. It might last 6 months or a year. It might last for one record or maybe a few, but you just don't know. And you always feel like you didn't treasure it enough when it was happening. Like, I saw a lot of Operation Ivy shows. I probably tried to see everyone that was anywhere near where I live, but in the aftermath, it was like, oh yes, but I could have gone to see that one and that one too. And why didn't I go see that one? And why didn't we do this? And why didn't we do that? And why didn't I read Jesse's lyrics sooner rather than later? And you know, why didn't I tell him how great I thought he was? And, you know, a million questions and recriminations. And yet, that's, you know, probably the aftermath or the, you know, what exists in the wake of greatness. You know, we were both very privileged to experience that band. You know, things like that don't come along that often.
Yeah.
You know, to being able to say, and to with some satisfaction, that we were there and that we were part of it, it's a great gift.
I
I just have one last question, and it only comes from having just read all these titles and you being able to speak immediately to them. I don't want to think it's a contradiction, so I'm going to ask what, since you said you don't think about these days as much, how do you just have a memory that remembers? Because that's a lot to remember just from someone who says they don't think about.
Well, this is what I'm saying about the creative process. It happens outside of time. It's more important than my personality. So even though I might not remember, you know, a lot of stuff, this stuff is going to, you know, something that's very strongly creatively anchored, like a powerful artistic experience, will stick in the memory because it's kind of larger than life in a way.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement, Episode 4. Later this month, I will be releasing the mostly unedited interviews of Larry Livermore and Jesse Michaels, so stay tuned for those. Next up, next month, in February, it'll be Tom Waits' Rain Dogs. See you then.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.